You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The race for California's Senate seat is one of the more high-profile races on the ballot. And this month, we've been sitting down with the leading candidates for Senate. We've aired conversations with Representatives Adam Schiff and Katie Porter, both Democrats, and have extended multiple invitations to Republican candidate Steve Garvey. Today, we'll listen to my conversation with Representative Barbara Lee, who is the longest-serving Congress member on the ballot. The Democrat represents Oakland and has been trailing in the polls, but that isn't stopping her in the final days to March 5th. Congresswoman Barbara Lee joins us to highlight the differences between her and the rest of the field. Representative Lee, thank you for taking the time on Insight.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
We are less than a week from the primary, and I just want to start off with recent polling. It's not the end-all be-all, but they are a useful snapshot. The recent polling that we were looking at shows you and your fellow Congressmember Katie Porter are trailing behind Congressman Adam Schiff, Republican newcomer Steve Garvey. How is that shaping your campaign with days left until March 5th?
Sure. Thanks a lot for giving me a chance to be with you. You know, we're very focused on our campaign and how we have organized our campaign, because what wins elections are voters voting for you, and they're only going to vote for you if they get to know you, know who you are, what you stand for, what your issues are that you've championed, what you have done already to make life better for everyone, and what you intend to do in the United States Senate. And so we have been phone banking, targeting our voters, chasing ballots, making sure our voters get to the polls. But also, for those who don't know me, getting a chance to speak directly to voters about who I am, what I stand for, and what I intend to do in the United States Senate. And I'm so proud to have the endorsements of Gen Z for Change, for example, of six out of the constitutional officers of our revolution. You know, Bernie Sanders beat President Biden by 10 points in California, and they're part of my campaign Get Out to Vote effort. Working Families Party. I mean, we have some phenomenal endorsers, and they are trusted messengers, and they are helping us get our voters to the polls so that we can be in the top two.
Does the polling concern you? How much stock do you give to polling, given that, I mean, you have the hindsight of, 26 years being in Congress, you've been through elections before.
Sure. And I read the polls. I know what the polls are, who they survey, who they call. And believe you me, that's a snapshot of the day or the time that the poll was taken. The best poll I have ever seen is the poll on election day, and that is making sure that your voters vote for you, and that involves targeting voters. And of course, money drives a heck of a lot, and we don't have the establishment necessarily money, but we have money from people that have historically donated to me, and I've raised a lot of money over the years helping other candidates so we can grow the House majority with Democrats. But money drives a lot of the polls, and most voters that I've talked to have never been polled before. But our campaign is a people-powered campaign, and many undecideds who were undecided, once they hear from me or know my message or hear from our surrogates, they come to our side to vote for me.
When it comes to deciding on a candidate for the primary, there are three Democrats on the ticket, and they are your colleagues in the House. We've spoken to Representative Adam Schiff and Katie Porter on the show. We have extended the offer as well to Republican Steve Garvey, and they have not replied. But can you tell us some differences between you and the other two of your Democratic colleagues that sets you apart specifically?
Sure, and it's interesting because there are more differences than there are similarities. The only similarity really are that we're all Democrats, myself, Mr. Schiff, and Ms. Porter. But when you look at perspective, lived experiences, who has delivered for people, who has fought for the most vulnerable in our state, when you look at 40 million people, 20 million living one paycheck away from poverty, lived experiences count. And I formerly was on public assistance, food stamps, Medi-Cal, finished college as a single mother with two small kids, didn't have enough money for childcare, so I had to take my kids to class with me. That's a big difference in myself and the other candidates, because it's a perspective that I bring, and it's being able to stand by myself sometimes in terms of foreign policy. Many may or may not know, but I was the only one who voted against the authorization to use force after the horrific events of 9/11. I was the only one in this race that voted against the Iraq War. I was the only one in this race who voted against the Patriot Act, which set up a system of spying on Americans. I've been the only one who called for a permanent ceasefire in this race. And I share that because I have a deep and broad background in national security and foreign policy, but it's a perspective of global peace and security. It's a perspective that the lens of a woman, a Black woman such as myself, brings to the Senate that no one else in this race brings. And it's because of the, you know, my experience as who I am, but also being able to understand the needs and aspirations of people who live in a state where they have to work 2 and 3 jobs, drive 2 and 3 hours to go to work, and just barely make it. And I've lived that. And I have fought for people to have a better life. And so I believe that one of the big differences is that I have a very clear understanding of our national security and global peace and foreign policy issues, as well as our domestic policy. And I've led and I've gotten out there by myself, oftentimes alone, even against my own party. And it takes leadership in the Senate to be able to get the job done.
I mean, as I mentioned, you've been in the House for 26 years, since 1998, representing Oakland. And this comes at a time, I mean, you talk about being the lone vote, you know, having to be a leader or an outlier in your own party. When it comes to bipartisanship, actually getting policies passed into law, bipartisanship is strained, to say the least. How do you work across the aisle so that bills become law? How do you compromise with colleagues that you may have some strong ideological differences with?
More than anyone in this race, I have a history of working in a bipartisan way with Republicans, Democrats, Independents, whomever. And you go back to my time in the California legislature when Pete Wilson, a very conservative governor, was the governor. He signed about 67 of my bills into law because I understand the nature of negotiations and I understand what people need and how to help people come to the table and have their voices heard. When you look at, for instance, President Bush, I was against each and every one of his policies. Again, voted against the authorization to use force. But when I talked to him about how many people were dying of AIDS in Africa and in the United States, he worked with me. And you know all of the global AIDS programs and funding that have been passed at the federal level, those were my bills, my legislation. And he signed them into law. And to this day, we have saved 25 million lives. And I'm very proud of that. Also, when you look at the Cannabis Caucus, I helped start the Cannabis Caucus. I'm the co-chair with Republicans. And we're fighting now with those who don't want to pass legalization of cannabis, because California, of course, is a state that has legalized medicinal and recreational. And I've been leading on that issue with Republicans, trying to get the Safe Banking Act passed. When you look at the repeal of the authorizations to use force, the Iraq authorization that I voted against and the Afghanistan authorization, I have 40 to 50 Republicans I work with to get these authorizations repealed. When you look at who has been fighting to get the Pentagon audited, we know there's $150 billion in waste, fraud, and abuse, taxpayer dollars. I went to a Republican and got the Republican to work with me to pass a law to require the Pentagon to be audited. The only agency that had never been audited, but guess what? They just flunked their 6th audit. So I work with Republicans day and night to get the job done if it means delivering for people. Nobody in this race has been able to work in a bipartisan way on so many issues that have been successful other than myself. And my record is very clear on the ability to work across the aisle when it comes to making sure I'm doing the work of the people. But when it comes to protecting our democracy, to fixing our democracy, to fighting against Donald Trump and the MAGA extremist Republicans, when it comes to our reproductive freedom and fighting to end the Hyde Amendment and to enshrine into federal law a woman's right to an abortion, when it comes to critical issues, then I don't back down. I fight for what is right. When there's common ground, then I am one of the few in the Congress, even right now, who works with Republicans to try to deliver for people in California.
So with that experience that you've had of being able to reach across the aisle, I mean, as you know, comprehensive immigration reform has been elusive for decades, and you've been in Congress since 1998. I mean, it's easy to assign blame, but if elected senator, where do you see yourself being most effective with immigration? Where can you make the biggest dent?
Sure, and it's not assigning blame. We had a chance when we had the House, Senate, and White House to pass comprehensive immigration reform, and we didn't. And I'm not attributing blame because I voted for it. And so we have to, a couple of things in the filibuster, of course, in the Senate. But having been born and raised in El Paso, Texas, in an immigrant community, comprehensive immigration reform has been on the top of my list of agenda items for many, many years. And what I would want to do in the Senate and what I would try to do is to try to make sure we have some comprehensive immigration reforms, but it has to be fair, it has to have due process, and it has to be orderly. And I would work with Democrats and Republicans to put forth a bill to make sure that our Dreamers have a pathway to citizenship, work with Senator Padilla to make sure that after 7 years, immigrants would be able to get a green card automatically, and work within the framework of understanding that border security without comprehensive immigration reform just won't work. And so as a person of color, as an African-American, as someone who knows the border issues and immigration and who fought against Donald Trump, I'm well prepared to work. And if I have to work with our outside groups to bring leverage to other Republicans who won't support reasonable pathways to citizenship for our immigrant population, then I will do that. And I believe one unique kind of perspective that I have is that I believe in democracy in a way that I work with our nonprofits, I work with our activists, I work with our organizations to bring to bear the voices of people within the United States House and now hopefully in the United States Senate.
Another pressing issue in California is homelessness and housing. Where do you see the federal government's role in finding a solution? The state has invested an unprecedented amount of funding. And I think if you ask a lot of Californians, they are not feeling the effects of that investment, of that funding. What could you do as a senator to alleviate this crisis of people who are unsheltered?
Again, going back to as one who understands this from a personal level, I've been unsheltered for a period of time in my life. And I know good and well that what we spend our money on in terms of federal dollars, we need to look at how we spend our money and what we do with our federal dollars. For example, we need to pass a national eviction prevention policy to prevent evictions. Secondly, in California, again, the affordability crisis is extreme and excessive. And people who are making minimum wage, who are low wage workers, can't afford first and last month's rent, move-in expenses, and a security deposit. So one effort I'm working on now that I would want to work on in the Senate, which is just an example, very practical kind of efforts, a deposit act where HUD would establish a revolving fund, and we have the money to do this in this country, for people to access for first and last month's rent security deposit, $10,000 to $15,000. Who in California making minimum wage can afford $10,000 or $15,000? That would solve a large portion of our crisis right there, that one small effort. Secondly, we have to invest in more housing tax credits, more affordable housing units need to be built. And I would champion systemic changes such as the Homelessness Act, which Congresswoman Waters has introduced to create over 410,000 more affordable housing, but also $10 billion to invest in long-term housing for unsheltered people. And also we have to have investments so that young people, especially in working men and women, can buy homes. HUD, again, could do that if, in fact, we invested in strategies. Like when I was a young woman, my government helped me. I was able to buy a house and develop that equity, which is the only way most people can grow wealth in this country, into being able to send my children to college and to start a small business where I employed hundreds of people. And so we have to see housing in a continuum. And also the Housing Trust Fund. We need more federal investments in the National Federal Housing Trust Fund, which I actually led on with Senator Sanders. And so there are ways to invest our tax dollars and get more for our money, and making sure that the mental health services and all of the support services are there for those who really need that kind of support. You just can't talk to an unsheltered person and say, you've got to get into a shelter, and then leave them just alone with no job training, no mental health services, no support services. And also, we have to make sure that we don't criminalize those who are living on the streets. And one of the policies I think that's extremely important is to make sure that we keep, I think 60% of the unsheltered population are people who go to jail, and they should not have to go to jail. We need teams of people, mental health workers, social workers, counselors to help people. And you know, it takes government to do this. But we need to do this differently so people don't end up in jail. And what is happening now is unconscionable. And I know we could better utilize our federal tax dollars to ensure more affordable housing and more sustainable housing for people who are low income.
On the topic, you mentioned affordability and the cost of living in California being incredibly difficult. One of the more headline grabbing things that you have said during debates, or it's been brought up during debates, is a $50 an hour federal minimum wage. I'd like you to expand upon that. Like, how would that make sense and how would that work?
What I said was this. When you look at raising the minimum wage, we're looking at a bill, Raise the Wage Act, that would raise the minimum wage in Washington. This is a federal minimum raise from $7.25 to $17 by 2028. I said that I would definitely support that and try to get that signed into law. We haven't had a raise in the minimum wage in over 10 years. Secondly, the minimum wage in California is $16. That is not a living wage. When you look at what is a living wage, it's documented, the data is there. For a family of four, $127,000, you're just barely making it. That's low income in many parts of California. So what I'm saying is, as yes, we have to raise the federal minimum wage to $17, but as we look at high cost states like California, we have to bring down the cost of living, first of all, by investing in housing and childcare, but we have to factor in affordability so that people can afford to live in California. The wage gap, wage inequality, economic inequality is growing. So you can't just leave the affordability factor off of the table when you talk about what it takes to live a decent life in California. And so $50 is not something that would happen overnight. I'm talking about doing the math, which I said, you do the math, $104,000 for a family of one. What does that come down to? What does it come down to, $127,000 for a family of four? And so we have to just understand that in these debates and in our commitment to make things better for people, we have to get to a living wage, and we have to not forget what affordability means in California, because people cannot afford to stay in California because the cost of living is too high.
Part of that affordability and those people are also business owners. I think about small businesses, especially in the last 4 years with the pandemic and the impacts of that that are still felt to this day. California has long been criticized for having an unattractive business climate. What could you do as senator to make California more business friendly so these business owners could succeed?
First of all, I'm a former small business owner, had hundreds of employees, so I understand the investments that are needed to grow our small businesses, because small businesses hire people and create economic growth. That's a given, but we are not doing enough for our small businesses. Secondly, billionaires and these corporations are making mega profits. They need to invest in their workers and in their employees. When you look at the tax structure and when you look at the fact that billionaires are not paying their payer taxes. The corporate tax rates are much too low. Investing in workers and employees will allow for businesses to grow and will allow for employees to be productive, good employees who will want to stay in California. And that is a fact.
As you know, this primary or this state is a top two. And Steve Garvey, the Republican candidate, is doing relatively well, at least as polling is concerned. I know the two of you share a lot of differences, especially when it comes to politics. But why do you think he is doing relatively well in polls with really no political experience?
Well, obviously, he voted, which I asked him, because he mentioned it, and the public understands he's voted for Donald Trump twice. And, you know, there are some who in California who believe that MAGA extremist Republicans who want to dismantle our democracy may be the right candidates. But I don't believe that Californians, the majority of Californian voters, want a Republican who is going to support Donald Trump and who has supported Donald Trump. And so it's hard to imagine, you know, he's a former baseball player. So, of course, he has name recognition. That more than likely is part of it, just the name recognition. But I think voters are smarter than that in California. And I think experience matters. I think representation matters. And I believe voters are going to vote for someone who has delivered for them, who believes in delivering federal funds to their districts and earmarks, who believes in fighting for people who have not been seen, for our immigrant population, and who believes in global peace and security. I don't believe the voters believe in a candidate who has voted twice for a Donald Trump, who has said very openly that he wants to establish an autocratic government and a dictatorship. And so the voters of California are very smart.
Well, finally, I mean, President Trump is on the ticket to become president again. If you're elected senator, and if Trump becomes president again, do you see a way where the two of you could have a productive relationship?
First, I'm going to do everything I can do to make sure that he is not elected. He does not deserve to be in the White House. I am the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit to hold himself accountable, he, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers. And so that is my first priority. Next, it's important to know that any president who is trying to dismantle our democracy needs to be opposed. If Donald Trump were elected, God forbid, and tried to do what he says he's going to do, I will fight every day to stop him from destroying our democracy. He is responsible for appointing Supreme Court judges, for example, for taking away our constitutional right to an abortion. He is trying to dismantle every single effort for racial and economic equity and inclusion. I will take him on any front that needs to be taken on. And of course, if something, a miracle happens and he wants to work for the people, then sure, I would definitely engage in whatever negotiations are needed to help people. But as it stands now, his agenda is not an agenda for the American people. His agenda is to destroy our democracy, and he does not deserve to be supported nor to be elected as president.
Representative Lee, thank you for the time and conversation.
Thank you.
That was our conversation yesterday with Representative Barbara Lee. The Democrat is running for U.S. Senate. We've also had similar conversations this month with Democratic Representatives Adam Schiff and Katie Porter, who are running for Senate as well. We also reached out multiple times to Republican candidate Steve Garvey's campaign, but we never heard back from them. Still ahead, an event at Sierra College this weekend is calling all artists who want professional development. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.